And now, Trunk and Disorderly, narrated by Tim Gerard Reynolds.
In which Laura departs and Fiona makes a request.
I want you to know, darling, that I'm leaving you for another sex robot, and she's twice the man you'll ever be,
Laura explained as she flounced over to the front door, wafting an alluring aroma of mineral oil behind her. Our arguments always began like that. This one was following the script perfectly. I followed her into the hall, unsure precisely what cue I'd missed this time. Laura? She stopped abruptly, a faint whine coming from her ornately sculpted left knee.
I'm leaving, she told me, deliberately pitching her voice in a modishly mechanical monotone. You can't stop me. You're not paying my maintenance. I'm a free woman. I don't have to put up with your moods.
The hell of it is, she was right. I'd been neglecting her lately, being overly preoccupied with my next auto-cremation attempt. I'm terribly sorry, I said, but can we talk about this later? You don't have to walk out right this instant.
There's nothing to talk about.
She jerked into motion again, reaching for the door handle.
You've been ignoring me for months, darling. I'm sick of trying to get through to you. You said last time that you'd try not to be so distant, but look how that turned out.
She sighed and froze the pose for a moment, the personification of glittering mechanistic melodrama.
You didn't mean it. I'm sick of waiting for you, Ralph. If you really loved me, you'd face up to the fact that you're an obsessive-compulsive and get your wetware fixed so that you could pay me the attention I deserve. Until then, I'm out of here.
The door opened. She spun on one chrome stiletto heel and swept out of my life in a swish of antique Givenchy and ozone.
Dash it all. Not again.
I leaned my forehead against the wall.
Why now, of all times?
Picking a fight, then leaving me right before a drop was one of her least endearing habits. This was the fifth time. She usually came right back afterward, when she was loose and lubed from witnessing me scrawl my butchness across the sky, but it never failed to make me feel an absolute bounder at the time. It's a low blow to strike a cove right before he tries to drill a hole in the desert at Mark 25, what? But you can't take femmes for granted, whether they be squish or clanky, and her accusation wasn't, I am bound to admit, entirely baseless. I wandered into the parlour and stood between the gently rusting ancestral spacesuits, overcome by an unpleasant sense of aimless tension. I couldn't decide whether I should go back to the simulator and practice my thermal curves again, balancing on a swaying metre-wide slab of ablative foam in the variable dynamic forces of atmospheric re-entry, a searing blowtorch flare of hot plasma roaring past bare centimetres beyond my helmet, or getting steaming drunk. I hate dilemmas. There's something terribly non-you about having to actually think about things.
You could never get too much practice before a freestyle competition, and I had seen enough clowns drill a scorched hole in the desert that I was under no illusions about my own invincibility, especially as this race was being held under mortal jeopardy rules.
On the other hand, Laura's walkout had left me feeling unhinged and unbalanced, and I'm never able to concentrate effectively in that state. Maybe a long, hot bath and a bottle of sake would get me over it, so I could practice later. But tonight was the pre-drop competitor's dinner. The club prefers members to get their crashing and burning done before the race, something to do with minimising our third-party insurance premium, I gather. So it's fried snacks all round, then a serving of rare sirloin, and barely a drop of the old firewater all night. So I was perched on the horns of an acute dilemma, to tipple or topple, as it were, when the room phone cleared its throat obtrusively.
Ralph? Ralphie, are you all right?
I didn't need the screen to tell me it was Fiona, my half-sister. Typical of her to call at a time like this.
Yes, I said wearily. You don't sound it, she said brightly.
Fee thinks that negative emotions are an indicator of felonious intent.
Laura just walked out on me again, and I've got a drop coming up tomorrow, I moaned.
Oh, Ralphie, stop angsting. She'll be back in a week when she's run the script. You worry too much about her.
She can look after herself. I was calling to ask, are you going to be around next week? I've been invited to a party Geraldine Ho is throwing for the downhill cross-country skiing season on Olympus Mons. But my house-sitter phoned in pregnant unexpectedly, and my herpetologist is having another sex change, so I was just hoping you'd be able to look after Jeremy for me while I'm gone, just for a couple of days, or maybe a week or two. Jeremy was Fiona's pet dwarf mammoth, an orange-brown, knee-high bundle of hairy malice. Last time I looked after Jeremy, he puked in my bed, under the comforter, while Laura and I were hosting a formal orgy for the Tsarevich of Ceres, who was travelling incognito to the inner system because of some boring edict by the Orthodox Patriarch condemning the flesh bits of Venus. Then there's the time Jeremy got at the port, then went on the rampage and ate Cousin Branwen's favourite skirt, when we took him to Lansdowne Palace for a weekend with Fluffy Morgan, even though we'd locked him in one of the old guard towers with a supply of whatever it was dwarf mammoths are supposed to eat. You can't really take him anywhere. He's a revolting beast, not to mention an alcoholic one.
"Must I
asked. "Don't whine," Fee said brightly. "Nobody will ever take you seriously if you whine, Ralphie. Anyway, you owe me a favour. Several favours, actually. If I hadn't covered up for you that time when Boris Obramov and you got drunk and took Uncle Fanshawe's yacht out for a spin around the moon without checking the antimatter reserve and the starboard gravity polarizer—"
"Yes, Fee,"
I said wearily, and she finally let me get a word in edgewise.
"I surrender. I'll take Jeremy, but I don't promise I'll be able to look after him if I die on the drop. You realize it's under mortal jeopardy rules, and I can't guarantee I'll be able to protect him from Laura if she shows up again running that bestiality mod your idiot pal Larry installed on her when she was high on pink noise that time."
"That's enough about Larry," Fee said in a voice like liquid helium. "You know, I'm not walking out with him any more. You look after Jeremy for 2 weeks, and that's enough for me. He's been a little sulky lately, but I'm sure you'd know all about that. I'll make sure he's backed up first, and I'll drop him off on my way to Sao Paulo Skyport, right?"
"What hell?" I said dispiritedly, and put the phone down. Then I snapped my fingers for a chair, sat down, and held my head in my hands for a while.
My sister was making a backup of her mammoth's twisted little psyche to ensure Jeremy stayed available for future torments. Nevertheless, she wouldn't forgive me if I killed the brute. Femmes. You or non-you, they're equally annoying. The chair whimpered unhappily as it massaged my tensed-up spine and shoulders, but there was no escaping the fact that I was stressed out. Tomorrow was clearly going to be one of those days, and I hadn't even scheduled the traditional pre-drop drink with the boys yet. The new butler calls. I was lying on the bottom of the swimming pool in the conservatory at the back of Chateau Pouquet, breathing alcohol-infused air through a hose and feeling sorry for myself, when the new butler found me. At least I think that's what I was doing. I was pretty far gone, conflicted between the need to practice my hypersonic pee-waggling before the drop and the urge to drink Laura's absence out of my system. All I remember is a vague, rippling blue curtain of sunlight on scrolled ironwork, the ceiling, then a huge, stark shadow looming over me, talking in the voice of polite authority.
"Good afternoon, sir. According to the diary, sir is supposed to be receiving his sister's mammoth in the front parlour in approximately 20 minutes. Would sir care to be sober for the occasion? And what suit should sir like to wear?"
This was about 4 more sirs than I could take lying down.
"Gurgle,"
I said, sitting up unsteadily. The breather tube wasn't designed for speech. Choking, I spat it out.
"M'gosh, and please excuse me, but who the hell are you?" "Alison Feng."
She bowed stiffly from the waist.
"The agency sent me to replace your last, man."
She was dressed in the stark black and white of a butler, and she did indeed have the voice. Some very expensive training, not to mention top-notch laryngeal engineering, went into producing that accent of polite condescension, the steering graces that could direct even the richest and most uncontrollable employer in directions less conducive to their social embarrassment. But,
"You're my new butler,"
I managed to choke out.
"I believe so."
One chiselled eyebrow signalled her scepticism.
Oh, oh, jolly good. Then that's squishy.
A thought, marinating in my sozzled subconscious, floated to the surface.
You, do you know why my last butler quit?
No, sir. Her expression didn't change. In my experience, it is best to approach one's prospective employers with an open mind.
It was my sister's mammoth's fault,
I managed to say, before a fit of coughing overcame me.
Listen, just take the bloody thing and lock it in the number 2 guest suite's dungeon, the one that's fitted out for clanky doms. It can try and destroy anything it bally likes in there. It won't get very far, and we can fix it later. Glue the door shut, or weld it or something. One of her boyfriends trained the thing to pick locks with its trunk. Gotta sober up.
Of course, sir. She snapped her fingers, and blow me if there wasn't one of those devilish red capsules balanced between her white-gloved digits.
Ugh!
I took it, and dry-swallowed, then hiccuped.
Fiona's animal tamer'll probably drop the monster off in the porch, but I'd better get up in case Sis shows.
I hiccuped again, acid indigestion clenching my stomach.
Blah. Was the invitation list for tonight?
Everything is perfectly under control, my new butler said, a trifle patronizingly. Now, if sir would care to step inside the dryer while I lay out his suit... I surrendered to the inevitable. After all, I thought, once you've accepted delivery of a dwarf mammoth on behalf of your sister, nothing worse can happen to you all day, can it? Unfortunately, I was wrong. Fiona's chauffeurs did indeed deposit Jeremy, but on a schedule of her own choosing. She must have already been on the way while Fee was nattering on the blower. While Miss Feng was introducing herself, she was sneakily decanting the putrid proboscidian onto the ornamental porch via her limousine's airlock. She accomplished this with stealth and panache and made a successful retreat, but not before she completed my sister's act of domestic sabotage by removing the frilly pink restraining rope that was all that kept Jeremy from venting his spleen on everything within reach. Which he commenced to do, all over great-uncle Arnold's snooker table, which I was only looking after while he was out-system on business. It was his triumphant squeaking that informed me that we had problems. Normally, Jeremy sneaks up on one in preternatural silence when he's got mischief in what passes for his mind, as I headed toward the stairs to my dressing room.
"Help me,"
I said, gesturing at the porch, from which a duet for Hell's Piccolo and Bull in a China Shop was emanating. The new butler immediately rose in my estimation by producing a bowler.
"Would this serve?"
she asked.
"Yes, only she's a bit short for a mammoth."
Too late. Miss Feng's throw was targeted perfectly, and it would have succeeded if Jeremy had been built to the scale of a typical pachyderm. Alas, the whirling balls flew across the room and tangled in the chandelier, while Jeremy, trumpeting and honking angrily, raised his tusks and charged at my kneecaps.
"Oh dear," said the new butler.
I blinked and began to move. I was too slow, the sober-up still fighting the residual effects of the alcohol in my blood. Jeremy veered toward me, tusks raised menacingly to threaten the old family jewels. I began to turn, and was just raising my arms to fend off the monster, who appeared dead set on editing the family tree to the benefit of Fiona's line, when Miss Feng leaned sideways and in one elegant gesture ripped the ancient lace curtains right off the rail and swiped them across my assailant's tusks. The next minute remains, mercifully, a confused blur. Somehow, my butler and I mammoth-handled the kicking and struggling, not to mention squealing and secreting, Jeremy, up the rear staircase and into the second-best guest suite's dungeon. Miss Feng braced herself against the door, while I rushed dizzily to the parlour and returned with a tube of Insta-Seal bulkhead bond, with which we reinforced the stout oak partition. Finally, my stomach rebelled, quite outraged by the combination of sober-up and adrenaline. At which point Miss Feng diffidently suggested I proceed to the master bathroom and freshen up while she dealt with the porch, the pachyderm, and my suit in descending order of priorities. By the time I'd cleaned up, Miss Feng had laid a freshly manufactured suit for me on the dresser.
"I took the liberty of arranging for a limousine to your club, sir," she said, almost apologetically. "It is approaching 18 o'clock. One wouldn't want to be late."
18? I blinked. "Oh, dear, that's dashed awkward."
"Indeed."
She watched me cautiously.
"Ah, about the agency."
I waved my hand dismissively. "If you can handle Jeremy, I see no reason why you couldn't also handle Great Uncle Arnold when he gets back from Proxima Tau Herpes, or wherever he has gone, not to mention the dread aunts, bless them. Assuming, that is, you want the job."
Miss Feng inclined her head. "Certainly one is prepared to assume the role for the duration of the probationary period."
Sotto voce, she added, almost too quietly for me to catch, "although continuing thereafter presupposes that one or both of us survives the experience." "Well, I'm glad that's sorted," I sniffed. "I'd better trot. If you can see the snooker table goes for a pair and look to the curtains, I'll be off, what?"
"Indeed, sir."
She nodded, as if about to say something else, thought better of it, then held the door open for me.
"Good night, sir."
The Dangerous Drop Club. I spent the evening at the Dangerous Drop Club, tackling a rather different variety of dangerous drop from the one I'd be confronting on the morrow. I knew perfectly well at the time that this was stupid, not to mention rash, to the point of inviting the attention of the dread aunts, those intellects vast and cool and unsympathetic. But I confess I was so rattled by the combination of Laura's departure, my new butler's arrival, and the presence of the horrible beast that, for the life of me, I simply couldn't bring myself to engage in any activity more constructive than killing my own brain cells. Boris Kaminsky was present, of course, boasting in a low-key manner about how he was going to win the race and buying everyone who mattered, the other competitors, in other words, as many drinks as they would accept. That was his prerogative, for, as the ancients would put it, there's no prize for second place. He wasn't the only one attempting to seduce his comrades into suicidal self-indulgence.
"We fly tomorrow, chaps, and some of us might not be coming back. Crack open the vaults and sample the finest vintages. Otherwise, you may never know."
Boris always gets a bit like that before a drop, morbidly maudlin in a gloating kind of way. Besides, it's a good excuse for draining the cellars, and Boris's credit is good for it. Kaminsky is not his real name, but the name he uses when he wants to be a fabulously rich playboy with none of the headaches and anxieties that go with his rank. This evening he was attired in an outrageous outfit modelled on something Tsar Putin I might have worn when presiding over an acid rave in the barbaric Dark Ages before the Re-Enlightenment. He probably found it in the back of his big brother's wardrobe.
"We know you only want to get us drunk so you can take unfair advantage of us,"
joshed Tolly Forsyth, raising his glass of Chateau Coum.
"But I say, let's drink a toast to you. Feet cold and bottoms up."
"Glug, glug,"
buzzed Toadsworth, raising a glass with his telescoping sink plunger thingy. Glasses were ceremoniously drained. At least, that's what I think he said. His English is rather sadly deficient, and one of the rules of the club is no neural prosthesis past the door, which makes it a bit dashed hard when you're dealing with fellows who can't tell a fuck from a frappe, I can tell you, like some high-bandwidth clanky airs. But that's what you get for missing out on a proper classical education. Undead languages and all, I say.
Goblets were ceremoniously drained in a libation to the forthcoming toast race.
"It's perfectly all right to get me drunk,"
said Marmaduke Bott, his monocle flashing with the ruby fire of antique stock market ticker displays.
"I'm sure I won't win, anyway. I'm sitting this one out in the bleachers."
"Drink is good,"
agreed Edgestar Wolfblack, injecting some kind of hideously fulminating fluorocarbon lubricant into one of his six knees. Most of us in the club were squishies, but Toadsworth and Edgestar are both clankies. However, while the toadster's knobbly conical exterior conceals what's left of his old squisher body, tucked decently away inside his eye turret, Edgestar has gone the whole hog and uploaded himself into a ceramic exoskeleton with 8 or 9 highly specialized limbs. He looks like the bastard offspring of a multi-tool and a manga bot.
"Carbon is the new..."
his massively armored eyebrows furrowed.
"Black?"
"He's a nice enough chappy, and he went to the right school, but he was definitely at the back of the queue the day they were handing out the cortical upgrades."
"Another wee dram for me," I requested, holding out my snifter for a passing bee-bot to vomit the nectar into. "I got a new butler today," I confided. "Nearly blew it, though. Sis dumped her pet mammoth on me again, and the butler had to clean up before I'd even had time to fool her into swearing the oath of allegiance."
"Oh, totally horrible," Abdul said in a tone that prompted me to glance at him sharply. He smirked. "And how is dear Fiona doing this week? It's ages since she last came to visit."
"She said something about the Olympic cross-country season, I think. And then she's got a few ships to launch. Nothing very important aside from that, just the après-ski salon circuit."
I yawned, trying desperately to look unimpressed.
"Abdul is the only member of the club who genuinely outranks Boris. Boris is constrained to use a nom de guerre because of his position as heir to the throne of all the Russias, at least all the Russias that lie between Mars and Jupiter. But Abdul doesn't even bother trying to disguise himself. He's the younger brother of His Excellency, the most spectacularly important emir of Mars. And when you've got that much clout, you get to do whatever you want.
Especially if it involves trying to modify the landscape at Mach 20 rather than assassinating your elder siblings, the traditional sport of kings.
Abdul is quite possibly certifiably insane, having graduated to freestyle orbital re-entry surfing by way of technical diving on Europa and naturalist glacier climbing on Pluto. And he doesn't even have my unfortunate neuroendocrine disorder as an excuse. And he's a fundamentally sound chap at heart."
"Huh. Well, we'll just have to invite her along to the party afterward, won't we?" he chuckled.
"Party?"
Toadsworth beeped up.
"Of course. It'll be my 100th drop, and I'm having a party."
Abdul smirked some more. He had a very knowing smirk, and sipped his 80-year Invertuch tea.
"Everyone who survives is invited. Bottoms up, chaps."
"Bottoms up," I echoed, raising my glass. "Tally-ho!"
The Sport of Kings. The day of the drop dawned bright and cold. At least it was bright and cold when I went out on the balcony beside the carport to suit up for my ride. Somewhat to my surprise, Miss Feng was already up and waiting for me with a hot flask of coffee, a prophylactic sober-up, and a good-luck cigar.
"Is this competition entirely safe, sir?"
she inquired as I chugged my espresso.
"Oh, absolutely not," I reassured her. "But I'd feel much better afterward. Nothing like realizing you're millimeters away from flaming meteoric death to get the old blood pumping, what?"
"One couldn't say."
Miss Feng looked doubtful as she accepted the empty flask.
"One's normal response to incendiary situations that get the blood pumping is a wound dressing and an ambulance, or to keep the employer from walking into the death trap in the first place.
Ahem. I assume, sir, intends to survive the experience?"
"That's the idea."
I grinned like an idiot, feeling the familiar pulse of excitement. It takes a lot to drive off the black dog of depression, but dodging the bullet tends to send it to the kennels for a while. By the way, if Laura calls, could you tell her I'm dying heroically to defend her virtue or something? I'll see her after. Oh, that reminds me. Abdul Al-Matsumoto has invited us, all the survivors, I mean, to a weekend party at his pad on Mars. So if you could see that the gig is ready to leave after my drop, as soon as I've dressed for dinner, and I don't suppose you could make sure there's a supply of food for the little monster, could you?
If we leave him locked in the garret dungeon, he can't get into trouble. Not beyond eating the curtains.
Miss Feng cleared her throat and looked at me reproachfully.
Sir did promise his sister to look after the beast in person, didn't he?
I stared at her, somewhat taken aback. Dash it all! Are you implying...
Miss Feng handed me my preemptive victory cigar. She continued in a thoughtful tone of voice.
Has Sir considered that it might be in his best interests, should he value the good opinion of his sister, to bring Jeremy along? After all, Lady Fiona's on Mars too, even if she's preoccupied with the après-ski circuit. If by some mischance she were to visit the Emir's palace and find Sir sans Jeremy, it might be more than trivially embarrassing.
Dash it all! You're right. I suppose I'll have to pack the bloody pachyderm, won't I? What a bore. Will you fit in the trunk?
Miss Feng sighed, very quietly.
I believe that may be a remote, theoretical possibility. I shall endeavour to find out while Sir is enjoying himself, not dying.
Try beer, I called, as I picked up my surfboard and climbed aboard the orbital delivery jitney. Jeremy loves beer.
Miss Feng bowed as the door closed.
I hope she doesn't give him too much, I thought. Then the gravity squirrelizer chittered to itself angrily, decided it was on the wrong planet, and tried to rectify the situation in its own inimitable way. I lay back and waited for orbit. I wasn't entirely certain of the wisdom of my proposed course of action. There are few predicaments as grim as facing a mammoth with a hangover across the breakfast table, but Miss Feng seemed like a competent sort, and I supposed I'd just have to trust her judgment. So I took a deep breath, waited another 60 seconds, until the alarm chimed, then opened the door and stepped off the running board over 300 kilometres of hostile vacuum.
The drop went smoothly, as I suppose you guessed. Otherwise I wouldn't be here to bend your ear with the story, what?
The adrenaline rush of standing astride a 10-centimetre-thick surfboard as it bumps and vibrates furiously in the hypersonic airflow, trying to throw you off into the blast furnace tornado winds of re-entry, is absolutely indescribable. So is the sight of the circular horizon flattening and growing, coming up to batter at your feet with angry fists of plasma. Ah, what rhapsody! What delight! I haven't got a poetic bone in my body, but when you tap into Toadsworth outside of the clubhouse's suppressor field, that's the kind of narcotic drivel he'll feed you. I think he's a jolly good poet, for an obsessive-compulsive clanky with a staircase phobia and knobbly protrusions, but at any rate, a more accurate description of competitive orbital re-entry diving I haven't heard from anyone recently.
A drop doesn't take long. The dangerous stage lasts less than 20 minutes from start to finish, and only the last 5 minutes is hot. Then you slow to subsonic velocity, let go of your smouldering surfboard, and pray to your ancestors that your parachute is folded smartly, because it would be mortifying to have to be rescued by the referee's skiff, especially if they don't get to you until after you complete your informal inquiry into lithobreaking, eh?
There was a high overcast as I came hurtling in across Utah, and I think I might have accidentally zigged instead of zagging a little too vigorously as I tried to see past a wall of cloud ahead and below me, because when my fireball finally dissipated, I found myself skidding across the sky about 50 kilometres off course. This would be embarrassing enough on its own. But then my helmet helpfully highlighted 3 other competitors, Abdul among them, who were much closer to the target zone. I will confess I muttered an unsportingly rude word at that juncture, but the game's the thing, and it isn't over till it's over. In the end, I touched down a mere 33,000 metres off course, and a couple of minutes later the referees ruled I was 3rd on target. Perry O'Perry, who had been leading me, managed to make himself the toast of the match before he reached the tropopause by way of a dodgy ring seal on his left knee. Dashed bad play, that, but at least he died with his boots on, glowing red-hot and welded to his ankles. I caught a lift the rest of the way to the drop base from one of the referee's skiffs. As I tramped across the dusty desert floor in my smouldering armour, feeling fully alive for the first time in weeks,
I found the party already in full swing. Abdul's entourage, all wearing traditional kimonos and burnouses, had brought along a modified camel that whittled champagne in copious quantities. He held up a huge platinum pitcher.
"Drinks are on me," he yodeled, as Tolly Forsyth and some rum cove of a grand vizier, Toshiro Ibn Cutthroat, I think, hoisted him atop their shoulders and danced a victory mazurka.
"Jolly good show, old son," I called, dishing my helmet and gloves gratefully and pouring a beaker of bubbly over my steaming head. "Bottoms up."
"Bims up indeed,"
Abdul sprayed camel flux everywhere in salute. He was well into the spirit of things, I could tell. Indeed, the spirit of things was well into him. Ibn Cutthroat's kid brother sidled up to me.
"If Ralphie Summer would care to accompany me to His Majesty's brother's pleasure barge, we will be departing from Mars as soon as the rest of the guests arrive," he intimated.
"Rest of the guests? Capital! Capital!"
I glanced around in search of my clanky doxy, but there was no sign of Laura, which was dashed strange, for she'd normally be all over me by this point in the proceedings. My nearly being turned off in front of an audience usually turned her on like a knife switch.
"Who else is coming?"
"Lots of people." Ibn Cutthroat Jr. looked furtive. "It's a very big party, as befits the prince's birthday. Did you know it was his birthday? It's a theme party, of course, in honour of the adopted ancestors of his ancient line,
the House of Saud."
Abdul al-Matsumoto is as much an authentic Prince of Araby as I am a scion of the MacGregor. But that's the price we all pay for being descended from the nouveau riche who survived the great downsizing hundreds of years ago. Our ancestors bought the newly vacated titles of nobility, and consequently we descendants are forced to learn the bally traditions that go with them. I spent years enduring lessons in dwarf tossing and caber dancing, not to mention damaging my hearing by learning to play the electric bagpipes. But Abdul has it worse. He's required by law to go around everywhere with a tea towel on his head and to refrain from drinking fermented grape juice unless it's been cycled through the kidneys of an over-engineered dromedary. This aristocratic lark has its downside, you mark my words.
"A theme party,"
I mused, removing my face from my cup.
"That sounds like fun. But I was planning on taking my gig. Is that okie-dokie, as they say? Is there room in the Imperial Marina?"
"Of course," said the vizier,
leering slightly as a shapely femme wearing a belly dancer's costume sashayed past. I noticed, with distaste, his hairless face and the pair of wizened testicles on a leather cord around his neck. Some people think testosterone makes a cove stupid, but there's such a thing as going too far, what?
"Just remember, it's a fancy dress party. The theme is the Thousand Nights and One Night, in honour of and for the selection of His Excellency's newest concuboid. His Excellency says you should feel free to bring a guest or two if you like. If you need an outfit..."
"I'm sure my household wardrobe will be able to see to my needs," I said,
perhaps a trifle sharply.
"See you there."
Ibn Cutthroat bowed and scraped furiously as he backed away from me.
Something odd's going on here, I realised. But before I could put my finger on it, there was a whoosh, and I saw the familiar sight of my gig.
Well, actually, it's Uncle Fanshawe's, but as he's not due back for 6 years, I don't think that matters too much. Descending to a perfect three-point landing. I walked over to it slowly, lost in thought, only to meet Miss Feng marching down the ramp.
"I didn't know you could fly," I said.
"My usual employer requires a full pilot's qualification, sir. Military unrestricted license with interstellar wings and combat certification."
She cleared her throat, among other skills. She took in my appearance, from scorched ablative boots to champagne hairstyle.
"I've taken the liberty of laying out Sir's smoking jacket in the master stateroom.
Can I suggest a quick shower might refresh the parts that Sir's friend's high spirits have already reached?
You may suggest anything you like, Miss Feng. I have complete confidence in your professional discretion. I should warn you, I will have a guest tagging along, but he won't be any trouble. If you show him to the lounge while I change, we shall be able to depart promptly. I don't suppose you've heard anything from Laura?
She shook her head minutely. Not so much as a peep, sir.
She stepped aside.
So I'm to set course for Mars as soon as the guest is aboard? Very good, sir. I shall be on the flight deck if you need me.
It appeared Miss Feng was not only an accomplished butler, but a dashed fine pilot as well. Would miracles never cease?
Miss Feng serves the wrong beer.
Uncle Fanshawe's boat is furnished in white oak panels with brass trim, ochre-crushed velvet curtains, and gently hissing gas lamps. A curving sofa extends around the circumference of the lounge, and for those tiresome long voyages to the outer system, there are cozy staterooms accessible through hidden sliding panels in the walls. It is a model of understated classical luxury in which a cove and his fellows can get discreetly bladdered while watching the glorious relativistic fireworks and the crystal screen that forms the ceiling. However, for the journey to Abdol's pleasure dome on Mars, it suffered from three major drawbacks. For one thing, in a fit of misplaced bonhomie, I'd offered Edge Star Wolfblack a lift, and old Edgy wasn't the best company for a post-drop preprandial, on account of his preferred tipples being corrosive or hypergolic or both. Secondly, Laura was still making her absence felt. And finally, as the icing on the cake, Miss Feng had locked Jeremy in the luggage compartment. He was kicking up a racket such as only a dwarf mammoth with a hangover can, and I could barely hear myself think over the din.
"Dash it all! How much beer did you give him?" I asked my butler.
2 liters, sir, Miss Feng replied, of the rather elderly Bragoat from the back of your uncle's laboratory. I judged it the least likely to be missed.
"Oh, dear God!" I cried.
"Bragoat?" echoed Edgy, as a plaintive squeal and a loud thud echoed from the underfloor bay.
By the sound of things, Jeremy was trying to dash his brains out on the undercarriage. Unfortunately, a dwarf mammoth's skull is thick enough to repel meteors and small antimatter weapons.
"Was that a mistake?" Miss Feng inquired.
I sighed. "You're new to the household, so I suppose you weren't to know this. But anything Uncle Fanshawe brewed is best treated as an experiment in creative chemical warfare. He was particularly keen on the Bragoat. It's a medieval recipe and requires a few years to mature to the consistency of fine treacle, but once you dilute the alcohol, it's an excellent purgative." "Oh, so I'm told," I added hastily, not wanting to confess to any teenage indiscretions.
"Oh dear." Her brow wrinkled. "One suspected it was a little past its prime, then. I packed another firkin in the hold, just in case it becomes necessary to sedate Jeremy again."
"I don't think that will work," I said regretfully. "He's not entirely stupid. Uncle was working on a thesis that the Black Death of 1347 wasn't a plague, but a hangover."
"Black Death? Is no post-humour of that nomenclature in my clade?" Edgy complained.
Bump went the floor beneath my feet, causing my teeth to vibrate.
"Only 2 hours to Mars," Miss Feng observed. "If Sir will excuse me, I have to see to his costume before arrival."
She retreated to one of the staterooms, leaving me alone with old Edgy and the pachydermal punctuation.
Pleasure Domes of Mars, a primer. I arrived on Mars somewhat rattled, but physically none the worse for wear. Miss Feng had rustled up a burnous, jalaba, and antique polyester two-piece for me from somewhere, so that I looked most dashing, absolutely in character, as a highly authentic leisure-suit Larry of Arabia.
I tried to inveigle her into costume, but she demurred.
"I am your butler, sir, not a party-goer in my own capacity.
It wouldn't be right. She tucked an emergency vial of aftershave in my breast pocket. It's hard to argue with such certainty, although I have a feeling that she only said it because she didn't approve of the filmy harem pants and the silver chainmail brassiere I'd brought along in hope of being able to adorn Laura with them. Edgestar we dressed in a rug and trained to spit on demand. He could be my camel, just as long as nobody expected him to pass champagne through his secondary reactor coolant circuit. Jeremy emerged from storage, pallid and shaking, so Miss Feng and I improvised a leash and decided to introduce him as the White Elephant. Not that a real White Elephant would have menaced the world with such a malign red-rimmed glare, or have smelled so unpleasantly fusty. But you can't have everything. A word about Abdul's digs. Abdul al-Matsumoto, younger brother of the Emir of Mars, lives in a Gothic palace on the upper slopes of Elysium Mons, 13 kilometres above the dusty plain. Elysium Mons is so big you'd hardly know you were on a mountain, so at some time in the preceding 5 centuries, one of Abdul's more annoying ancestors vandalized the volcano by carving out the Aerophysical Folly, a half-scale model of Mount Everest protruding from the rim of the caldera. Thus, despite the terraforming that has turned the crumbly old war god into a bit of a retirement farm these days, Abdul's pleasure dome really is capped by a dome of the old-fashioned do-not-break-glass, do-not-let-air-out-unless-you-want-to-die variety. Ground control talked Miss Feng down into the marina below the sparkly glass facets of the dome, then sent a crawler tunnel to lock onto the door before old Edgy could leap out onto the surface and test his vacuum seals. The door opened with a clunk. "Let's go, what?" I asked Jeremy. Jeremy sat down, swiveled one jaundiced eye toward me, and emitted a plaintive honk. "Be like that, then," I muttered, bending to pick him up. Dwarf mammoths are heavy, even in Martian gravity, but I managed to tuck him under my arm and, thus encumbered, led the way down the tube toward Abdul's reception. "If you are ever invited to a party by a supreme planetary overlord spoiled playboy of a younger brother, you can expect to get tiresomely lost unless you remember to download a map of the premises into your monocle first. Abdul's humble abode boasts 2,428 rooms, of which 796 are bedrooms, 915 are bathrooms, 68 are offices, and 147 are dungeons. There's even a choice of 4 different planetary overlord command bunkers, each with its own colour-coordinated suite of doomsday weapon control consoles, for those occasions on which one is required to entertain multiple planetary overlords. If the palace was maintained the old-fashioned way, by squishy servants, it would be completely unmanageable. But it was designed in the immediate aftermath of the Martian hyper-scabies outbreak of 2407 that finished off those bits of the solar system that hadn't already been clobbered by the great downsizing. Consequently, it's full of shiny, clicky things that scuttle about when you're not watching and get underfoot as they polish the marble flags and repair the amazingly intricate lapis lazuli mosaics and refill the oil lamps with extra virgin olive oil. It still needs a sizable human staff to run it, but not the army you'd expect for a pile several sizes larger than the Vatican Hilton. I bounced out of the boarding tube into the entrance hall and right into the outstretched arms of Abdul, flanked by 2 stern, silent types with swords, and a supporting cast of houris, hashishin, and hangers-on.
"Ralphie-san," he cried, kissing me on both cheeks and turning to show me off to the crowd. "I want you all to meet my honoured guest, Ralph MacDonald Suzuki of MacDonald, 5th Earl of that clan, a genuine Japanese Highland laird from old Scotland. Ralphie is a fellow skydiver and all-round good egg. Ralph, this is Vladimir Ilyich of Ulyanov, chief commissar of the Soviet Union."
Ulyanov grinned. Under the false pate, I could see it was our old drinking chum, Boris the Tsarevich.
"And this, why, Edgy, I didn't recognize you in that. Is it a llama?"
How very realistic.
No, he's meant to be a monkey, explained Wolfback, twirling so that his false camel-skin disguise flapped about.
I opened my mouth to tell him that the barrel Miss Fang had strapped to his back to provide support for the hump had slipped, but he turned to Abdul.
You like?
Jolly good, that outfit.
Pip, pip,
said Toadsworth, whirring alongside with a glass of the old neurotoxins gripped in one telescoping manipulator. I think it might have been a high-bandwidth infoburst rather than a toast, but due to my unfortunate hereditary allergy to implants, I'm very bad at spotting that kind of thing. Which way to the bar, old fellow?
That way,
suggested Ibn Cutthroat, springing from a hidden trapdoor behind a Ming vase. He pointed through an archway at one side of the hall.
Be seeing you.
His eyeballs gleamed with villainous promise. A black-robed figure in a full veil was staring at me from behind two implausibly weaponized clanky hashishin at the back of the party. I got an odd feeling about them, but before I could say anything, Toadsworth snagged my free hand in his gripper and began to tug me toward the old tipple station.
Come on, inebriate, he buzzed. All enemies of sobriety must be inebriated. Pip-pip.
Jeremy let out a squealing trumpet blast close to my ear and began to kick. Not having a third hand with which to steady him, I let go and he shot off ahead of us, stubby ears flapping madly in the low Martian gravity.
Oh, dear, said Miss Fang.
Why don't you just run along and see to my chambers? I asked, irritated by the thought that the bloody elephant might poop in the punch bowl, or worse, dip his whistle in it, before I got there. Leave the beast to me. I'll sort him out later.
Inebriate! Inebriate!
Cried Toadsworth, hurtling forward, the lights of his cortical turret flashing frantically.
To the party!
In which Ralph explains the nature of his relationship with Laura. Now, in the normal course of affairs, it behooves a young fellow to remain discreet and close-lipped about matters of an embarrassingly personal nature. But it's also true to say that this story won't make a lot of sense without certain intimate understandings, and nods as good as a wink to a deaf hedgehog and all that. And in any event, ever since the minutiae of my personal affairs became part of the public gossip circuit, following the unfortunate affair involving the clanky dominatrix, the cat burglar, and the alien hive mind, it would be somewhat hypocritical of me to stand upon my privacy. So, where a more modest cove might hesitate, please allow me to step in and, at risk of offending your sensibilities, explain something about my complex relationship with Laura. I rather fancy that life must have been much simpler back in the days of classical Anglo-American civilization, when there were only two openly acknowledged genders and people didn't worry about whether their intimate affairs were commutative, transitive, or reflexive. No clanky, squishy, no you or non-you, nothing but the antique butch-femme juxtaposition, and that was pretty much determined by the shape of the external genitalia you were born with. Perverts dashed well knew what they were, and life was simple. Modern life is enough to drive a cove to drugs, in my opinion, but as a butch-you-squishy of impeccable ancestry, I have the social option of maintaining a mistress, not to mention the money, and that's where Laura comes in.
Laura is very clanky and very frilly femme with it, but with a squishy core and just sufficiently non-you to make a casual relationship marginally acceptable to polite society on the usual sub-rosa morganatic basis. We met on a shooting weekend at one of the Pahlavi girls' ranches on Luna, doing our bit for evolution by helping thin the herd of rampaging feral bots during their annual migration across the Sea of Tranquility.
She was working her way around the solar system on a cut-price non-U grand tour, labouring as a courtesy masseuse in Japan and as a topiarist on Ceres while saving up the price of her next interplanetary jaunt. Her parental unit was sending her a small allowance to help pay her way, I think, but she was having to work as well to make ends meet, a frightfully non-U thing for a cute little clanky princess to have to do.
Our eyes met over the open breech of her silver-chased purdy over and under EPM cannon, and as soon as I saw her delicately wired eyelashes and the refractive sheen on her breasts, simultaneously naked and deliciously inaccessible in the vacuum, I knew I had to have her. "Why, I do declare I'm out of capacitors," she fluttered at me, and I bent over backward to offer her my heart and the keys to the guest room. There is something more than a little perverse about a squish who chases clanky skirt. Even, one might suppose, something of the invert about them, but I can cope with sly looks in public. And our butch femme, you non-utable, is sufficiently orthodox to merely outrage the aunts, rather than crossing the line and causing offence. If she showed more squish while being less non-you, I suppose it would be too risque to carry on in public. But I digress. I trust you can sympathise with my confusion. What else is a healthy boy to do when his lusts turn in a not-quite-respectable direction? Of course, I was younger and rather more foolish when I first clapped eyes on the dame, and we've had our ups and downs since then. To be fair, she was unaware of my unfortunate neurohormonal problem, and I wasn't entirely clear on the costs, both mechanical and emotional, of maintaining a clanky doxy in the style to which she would expect to become accustomed. Nor did I expect her to be so enthusiastic a proponent of personality patches, or so prone to histrionic fits and thermionic outrages. But we mostly seemed to bump along all right, until that last pre-drop walkout, and her failure to turn up at the drop zone.